Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. Tonight we're going to, do last night's program, actually. And we'll be replaying that. And we have an interview with a friend named Dr. Kutch, Andre Kutch, who is a anesthesiologist, but he's written a great book, and it's called, and he's written several actually, regarding preparing for surgery, and he's dealing with children, preparing children for surgery actually, and the psychology behind that, and what comes and what as a physician, but it's an unusual interview for us, I guess. But I think you'll enjoy it. And I hope you enjoy the show. So here we go.
Also, another book that I'm going to talk to him about is called Golden Apples, which is a medieval tale, and it's a clever approach to drug education. And I particularly like that one, so I'm going to talk to him about that, and also Will It Hurt. We'll have our regular guests in the ring with Woody at the top of the hour at 9 o'clock, and we hope John will be with us. If he doesn't have technical problems, he called us earlier and said he did, he'll let us know if he's going to be on. So I would like... Everything all
straightened
out there, Leo?
Yeah, I had a bunch of problems there with volume.
He's all set now.
So we're back. We're on record and so on now. So okay.
But it's Tuesday, and yesterday was day to remember Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
We weren't on the air on Monday, so we couldn't remember him particularly on that day. But we would like to talk a little bit about him today.
There's a lot of people. We brought this up
last year.
Yeah, last year at the same time, because it was very something we hadn't heard about before, and many people had never heard of this either. But I will want to read it to you again tonight.
Yeah, as
I think it's going to open your eyes to something we've been saying and believing all of our lives ever since 1968. You know, that the government was involved with the killing of Martin Luther King. And now we have, there's proof. So.
Well, first, let me give a little preface to that. On Monday, January 17, 2011, marks the holiday honoring the birth of Martin Luther King. And a brief chronology about him. On April 3, 1968, King traveled to Memphis to support striking AFSCME sanitation workers.
That evening,
the lead up. That evening, he delivered his famous I've Been to the Mountaintop speech to a packed room of supporters, and the next day he was assassinated. But one of the things that he faced was a very hostile political climate. And in his last speech, he stood in solidarity with working people. And he said that the labor movement was the principal force that transformed the misery and despair into hope and progress. And when in the 30s, this is a quote from him, another line, when in the 30s the wave of union organization crested over the nation, it carried to secure shores not only itself but the whole society. And what they brought was unemployment insurance, old age pensions, government relief for the destitute, and new wage levels that meant not mere survival but a tolerable life. So I'm sure there were many people that didn't care for that very much, and I just wanted to remind people of what the climate was. Okay, in the truth movement, this is what they say. And this is what happened.
That was truth. That's not the truth movement.
The article is from Truth Move.
Truth Move.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the truth movement. It's an actual website.
I realize that, Lee.
No, it's a website dedicated to Martin Luther King and the concern and what happened. So I just wanted you to know that it's not part of the truth movement.
Oh, I was incorrect, folks, on that. I apologize.
Yeah,
I don't want to mislead people, but this. Who who is responsible for the website? I don't know that.
Truth Move.
And who are who?
They're just the organization.
The organization.
Yeah,
okay, this is what they're telling us. Number one, a civil trial by the King family in 1999 found the defendants, Lloyd Jowers and other unknown co-conspirators, guilty in the wrongful death of Martin Luther King Jr. In the trial, these unknown co-conspirators were specifically named as the United States government, the state of Tennessee, the city of Memphis, the Memphis Police Department, James Earl Ray, Earl Clark, top marksman in Memphis PD, Frank Liberato, a mafia king, and J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, Richard Helms and the CIA, and the military. This historical trial was effectively blacked out of the U.S. media, as the implications were simply too devastating to the establishment. Ray consistently claimed he had a handler named Raul with whom he was involved in a gun-running operation. Despite detailed documentation of the individual's presence and existence, witness accounts, photographs, and records, the government maintains that Raul never existed. At Ray's evidentiary hearing, a former FBI ballistics expert testified that not even the most skilled gunman could have accurately fired a rifle in the manner claimed by the government prosecution. The FBI leaked information to the local press that King was staying at the white-owned Holiday Inn, causing him to switch his accommodations to the less secure Motel Lorraine, where he was killed. An unknown man pretending to be with King's party came to the motel the day before King arrived and specifically requested a balcony room on the second floor. The bullet recovered from King's body has not been adequately tested and has not been proved to match Ray's alleged murder weapon. Shortly before the killing, King's police security detail was reduced from 8 officers to 2 officers, in spite of the more than 50 death threats against the civil rights leader. Just hours before the shooting, a black officer named Edward Reddit was sent home because of a mere serious threat against his life. This left just one policeman on the immediate scene. So those are some things for people to think about, especially the fact that there was a civil trial by the King family in 1999.
And the government lost, it was implicated as the as co-conspirators, all
mm-hmm.
right, and this. And there's much more to that article, and there was also a book written that came out in 2003 by the King family lawyer. And that thing was buried in the mud, boy. It came out through Verso Press, I believe, V-E-R-S-C-O, Versco Press. And I was unable to pull that all up tonight. For some reason, I missed the website. But there's a lot of information. If you go under wrongful death, Martin Luther King, and Martin Luther King, wrongful death lawsuit, you'll find that it did happen, it was real, and a jury did decide that the U.S. government, the FBI, and
the city of Memphis,
right, all were implicated.
You have to remember that Martin Luther King was not just an advocate for black people, he was an advocate for the poor, and that was a very scary thing to a lot of people.
Well, what happens is if you start to, he was against the Vietnam War.
Uh huh.
But if you start to advocate, like right now, if people realize that this was a war between the rich and the poor, all right, that everything is a war, basically,
mm-hmm.
between the rich and the poor. The rich people don't. The rich people make money off of war. The poor people get killed off of war. Okay. That's the way it is. Now, Martin Luther King wanted to organize the poor. He wanted to organize the poor. And it's like, I was thinking of Selowinski, the radical, who wanted, his major goal was to organize the middle class.
That's right.
Right, in this country. And unfortunately didn't live long enough to do that. But Martin Luther King didn't get a chance to. But he may very well have been able to organize the poor the way he did them. But that was one of J. Edgar Hoover's biggest fears, all right, as well as all of the Kennedy boys and everybody else who were scared to death of this stuff happening.
Yeah, anybody
and,
who was a globalist
yeah,
didn't want
and
that to
everybody.
Happen.
Yeah, so they had to knock him off, and they knocked him off. And they were found guilty back in 1999, finally, when the family took them all to court. So anyway, that just so you know, that's a little real background on Martin Luther King's death.
So it didn't quite happen as it's written in the history books.
No, just as most stuff doesn't happen the way it happens.
That's called revisionist history.
But, you know, I was a little startled when you said that. I mean, nobody, you know, even the unions don't even talk about it. Even black history doesn't even talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, well, you know, it's like a total mockery. It's a joke. Here they're erecting a statue to the greatest civil rights leader in the world in Washington, D.C. They got a holiday on for him. Yet the reality of the situation is that this government killed him.
Certainly were indicted as co-conspirators.
Yeah, they killed him. And let's kill another hero. You know, it's unbelievable. I mean, the maggots that operate this government and the hypocrisy that prevails throughout this country is just a sickening disease. And it's absolutely staggering. But we go on and we prevail. But we all know that those who have listened tonight know that Martin Luther King was killed by the United States, not by some idiot named James Earl Ray. All right? It's unbelievable. So anyway, yes, do you want to read something more seething than this one? I got the courts rule government can keep naked body scanners images secret. So if you think your body scanning pictures aren't being saved, you're an idiot, okay? No matter how saggy or how old or how young or how beautiful or how sculptured your body may be, yes, it'll be on the internet soon under some, God forbid, YouTube, X-rated video. All right?
Because we were certainly misled about that.
Yeah. You want me to read that or you want to?
Go right ahead.
I'm ticked off enough to read it. All right. This is by Steve Watson, prison plan. Friday, January 14th. A federal judge has ruled that the Department of Homeland Security can keep images produced by X-ray body scanners out of the public domain. In a blow to privacy groups, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, efforts to release more than 2,000 of the images that show intimate details of airport travelers' bodies. Judge Ricardo Urbana ruled that the Department of Homeland Security does not have to comply with the Freedom of Information Act request to disclose the naked images of those who were screened at airport checkpoints, nor does the government have to release any other related materials. The judge granted the government's motion to conclude the lawsuit, issuing a 15-page explanation, noting that the images are used to train employees and any public disclosure of such material could reveal vulnerabilities in the technology, thus threatening public disclosure of such material could reveal, the agency's security. Such disclosures could provide terrorists with others and others with increased abilities to circumvent detection by TSA and carrying threatening contraband on board. Urbina wrote that the images EPIC requested are so closely related to TSA's rules or practice that their disclosure would reveal the rule or practice itself. And the judge added, citing substantial public interest in the release of the images, Epic lawyers John Verdi and Mark Rottenberg noted that the government has already released some scanner images into the public domain. Therefore, there is no justification for keeping the rest under wraps. The body scanner program is presently the subject of substantial debate in Congress between international delegations and in the media, and attorneys wrote in a paper submitted last year. And though the ruling is technically a defeat for Epic,
The justification that the images are used for training purposes proves that the machines are indeed store and transmit images, a fact that was vehemently denied by the government during the rollout of the technology into the airports across the country. Epic has therefore essentially achieved its aim of exposing how the government misled the public and then actively lied to the media on several occasions to quell a backlash against the invasive technology. And as part of the litigation, Epic also obtained several documents related to these body scanners, which have since been released to the public. And they include details relating to the procurements and specifications, operational requirements, traveler complaints, and vendor contracts. Though they are heavily redacted, these documents do also prove that the devices can store, record, and transmit data. Hey, this is absolutely a sick bunch of folks, man. Hey, if you want to go to that, you go to Infowars.net and check out that article in its entirety.
And how they stand up there and assure you that the images are not stored, nobody's going to see them.
The government lies to you. They to you. And if anybody believes anything this government says to you, you're an idiot. I mean, you're absolutely an idiot. So I'm sorry, folks. Just don't believe it. Just doesn't make sense. Like everybody believes that Martin Luther King was killed by some clown named James Earl Ray. That didn't happen. All right, he was killed by J. Edgar Hoover and the boys and the Memphis Police Department. And yes, so there we go.
Okay.
All right, and I got another one really funny in a minute, but go ahead.
Former NSA chief called CIA out of control. This is by Sharon Weinberger on Global Research. The CIA is out of control and often refuses to cooperate with other parts of the national security community, even undermining their efforts, said former National Security Agency head William Autumn, according to a recently released record of a 9/11 commission interview.
What?
The CIA currently doesn't work for anyone. It thinks it works for the president, but it doesn't, and it's out of control, says a report summarizing remarks made by Autumn, a retired three-star general who served as director of NSA from 1985 to 1988. Autumn, who also served on the National Security Council staff during the Carter administration, was known as an outspoken advocate for intelligence reform. He died in 2008. The 2003 interview, among others conducted by the 9/11 Commission, was posted on the website Cryptome, which is often compared to the secret spilling WikiLeaks website. The report was not a leak, however, but one of many records relating to the 9/11 Commission that have been released and made available on the National Archives website. Quite a few remain access restricted for classification review. John Young, who runs Cryptome, also told AOL News in an email about the records, some of which he has reposted. We expect to make a Freedom of Information Act request for the release once we have a full listing of those that are restricted. In the commission interview, Autumn portrayed the CIA offices as individualistic, saying they were interested in writing exposés. He also accused the CIA of not sharing humanit, meaning intelligence collected through contact with people, and of trying to sabotage the Pentagon's own work in this area. The director of the CIA has as much reason to brief the president as the man on the moon, Autumn told the staff of the commission investigating the failure to prevent the terror attacks. Autumn believed that the intelligence officials weren't held sufficiently accountable for the attacks on September 11, 2001. He said he believed the heads of NSA and the CIA should both have been fired by the president after 9/11 for symbolic purposes. And that was his opinion. You wonder how much has changed.
Yes. Anyway.
And he died, as it said, in
2008. Yeah.
So,
I know. I thought that was an excellent article. I mean, the guy came right out and said it.
Well, doesn't that sort of substantiate the book that one of our guests had, the gentleman from Springfield? Remember, he was talking about
He was talking about the DEA.
But he also talked about all the agencies, how they compete against each other, fight with each other.
They all screw each other over. They're all dirty.
Yeah, there's no cooperation, and they're all individualistic.
Yeah, and they're all dirty, and they're all getting their own drug deals and everything else. It's like unbelievable.
But this is what he was alluding to. He didn't really come right out and say it. But he was
top man.
Yeah.
So
that's support for the for that book I can't think of his name.
Trine Day was the publisher.
Yeah. Excellent book.
Running with the Pack or something like that.
Yes.
Running with the Pack.
Do you remember the author? You're better at that.
Danielson or I forget.
Yeah.
Go to Trine Day. Publishers, you can.
If you're interested in reading about that area,
it's a fascinating area.
Excellent
book. We've had a lot of good authors, on that from that publisher, in probably the last 6 months or so. But this one was something to do with Running with the Pack or something like that. I forgot. It was an excellent book, but anyway. Before we come up, we got a great interview coming up tonight. I should remind everybody
Dr. Ketch.
Dr. Ketch. His actual name is Armin Ketchatian. Okay, he's a great doctor, and he's a local doctor. Actually, he works up at Sharon Hospital. And I met him up there, and he actually worked on me. and he was a good anesthetic,
anesthesiologist.
Knocked me out very well. Appreciated that.
Brought you back, Barbara.
Brought me back very
That's
well.
That's the important part.
And did that several times, actually, through the course of a week. And I appreciate him very much. But I wanted to, he's got a great book up. And it's called Will It Hurt? And it's a parent's practical guide to children's surgery. And he's got a new one coming out pretty soon about a practical guide to adult surgery. And we're going to talk to him about that. And, yeah, I think you're going to really like him. He's quite a guy. And let's see.
Before we bring him up.
Yeah, before we bring him up, Lila insists I go here. Okay, so I'm not going to go here yet because I'm not ready for it, but we will get there. When the time comes, if I can find it. Yes, found it, Lila. Yeah. All right. We'll go to a commercial break in just a second, as soon as it comes up. All right? And I got one. This one may be a little too long, but... No, actually, it's not.
Okay, because I have a short one.
Which one? You got a couple of shorties there. Which one we know?
Florida oil spill. This is...
Why don't you... Yeah, those are two on that one page. Those were better. This one I can keep till...
Frustration over the claims process continued to build as small businesses struggle to survive. Kenneth Feinberg will no doubt hear some of those frustrations when he visits the coastal communities in Alabama today. Some say what he is doing is criminal. At least one Gulf Coast business council lays some pretty serious charges at the feet of Kenneth Feinberg and the entire claims process. They don't want to pay the money out, and that's why I say they are holding the businesses and the people hostage. Norman Schumann says 500 small businesses have come to him for help at the Business Support Center. Earlier this month, Alabama Governor Bob Riley called Feinberg's claim process extortion, and outgoing of Alabama Attorney General Troy King issued a consumer alert warning people that Feinberg works for BP. Feinberg was named by President Obama, though BP is paying him and four other lawyers at his firm $850,000 a month to run the fund. So...
There was one more there, too, that on that same page.
Let's see. A top Democrat said the attacks on... This is by Sean Miller. This is from thehill.com. A top Democrat said the attack on Representative Gabrielle Giffords should change how members of Congress are screened at airports. I really believe that this is the place where we feel the most ill at ease is going through airports, Representative James Clyburn, who serves as Assistant Minority Leader in the House, said on Fox News Sunday. Kleinberg called for the Transportation Security Administration, which administers airport security checkpoints, to interact a little better with the Capitol Hill police. We've had some incidents where the TSA authorities think that Congress people should be treated just like everybody else, he said. Well, the fact of the matter is we are held to a higher standard in so many other areas. I think we need to take a hard look at exactly how the TSA interact with members of Congress.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. No, no scanning those guys. You can't scan and keep pictures of Pelosi or Claiborne or, you know, Boehner. Boehner will probably start crying.
Oh, yeah.
Don't take a picture of me. Anyway, we're going to go away quickly for a quick commercial break and be back with our guest, Dr. Ketch. How to serve you. They keep our streets and parks clean.
They make our schools a great place to learn.
They keep violent felons out of our community.
They even help our children get to school safe and on time.
They are the 35,000 public service employees represented by Council 4.
These employees are dedicated and efficient.
They are accountable to Connecticut taxpayers. That means they don't work for privatized agencies that may hire substandard, non-union workers.
Companies like these are constantly in the headlines with their corruption scandals, which cost taxpayers millions.
That's why it's important to keep public services in public hands with people who work hard around Connecticut and around the clock.
On the state and the local level.
Public service employees are proud to serve you every single day.
Find out more at council4.org. Council 4, AFSCME, a union for all. This ad is brought to you by the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. This union is affiliated with the AFL-CIO.
All right.
Hey, we're back. And while Leo brings up our guest, he's going to give him a call. I'll tell you a little bit about him. Dr. Armin Ketchagian. I hope I pronounced his name right. I'm sure he'll correct me if I didn't do it properly. He calls himself Dr. Ketch. He is a former assistant professor at Yale University School of Medicine and is listed in the Guide to America's Top Anesthesiologists by the Consumer Research Council of America. He trained at Cornell Medical Center with a fellowship at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and a pain management elective at Boston Children's Hospital in the Department of Anesthesiology. Dr. Ketch is the author of the children's book, Golden Apples. And we're going to talk about his book, Will It Hurt? A Parent's Practical Guide to Children's Surgery. And it's quite a book, something that all parents should have if their child is going into surgery or into the hospital.
That's better, right? Okay.
So I think Dr. Ketch is with us now. Good evening, Dr. Ketch. Welcome to the LA Steel Show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate being on your show.
Well, we're really glad to have you. And Leo and I both went through your book, Will It Hurt? A Parent's Practical Guide to Children's Surgery. And certainly I would think that most parents, or if not all, whose child is going into the hospital would get a lot of comfort from reading your book and having it with them so they know the correct questions to ask and what to expect. Now, you're very much on the other side, of course. You're the person dealing with the child or the person that's in surgery. Did you have any particular situations that kind of compelled you to write this book, Will It Hurt?
I think mostly that conveyed the inspiration to write this book was meeting parents who seemed very lost.
Mm-hmm.
In turn, their children being lost in this jungle of medical care. And when I was at professor of school of medicine with Zev Kane, who did all these studies, seeing parents and children who were very well-versed and understood what was going to happen, their children did much better with surgery. They required less medications, they had shorter hospital stays, and had fewer side effects. And that helped me inspire to write this book. And it was a book designed specifically to help both parents and children to smoothly course through the aspects of surgery and in turn answer any questions and any
I think, you know, if I wouldn't mind reading this book myself if I were going into surgery. I was thinking as I was reading it, this would also help any adult who was going into the hospital as well.
Well, absolutely. This book, you know, multiple different aspects, you know, whatever child would face surgery, most adults will also face surgery. This book is specifically designed for a family because of the uniqueness of the parents and child dynamics. But yes, you know, what a child goes through surgery is the same thing that an adult would go through surgery, and many adults will actually benefit from reading a book like this. And the book was specifically designed to be able to be read by anybody from any background and to understand what would be expected and what would happen from the time that they discover they need surgery to the period when they are ready to undergo surgery, in terms of who do I go to see, where do I go, what do I need to do, why is this being done, why do I need this test, what is anesthesia, why do I need anesthesia, and what's going to happen through the process of surgery, and what will recovery be like after surgery. So these are important questions that most people have no idea that they're going to be facing until the time of the surgery. And yes, you know, everybody will benefit from certain aspects of this book who's going to undergo surgery at some point.
You know, if I can just mention, there was one segment that it didn't surprise me, but it took me back a little bit because there's so many obese children, and they face a lot more trouble going into a surgical situation, don't they? As far as I noticed, there was in your book, it said something about breathing. It said you know, different things that different risks that they have that aren't similar to other kids who are more
average weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are some of the maybe you can tell people, like, for instance, when a kid is obese, what is it, 20 or 30 pounds of over his over average, or what? What constitutes an obese child? How big do you have to be to qualify as an obese kid?
Well, we in the medical community, anyone who's at least 20% above ideal body weight, and, you know, there are all these charts that are available from pediatricians' offices that would delineate what is ideal body weight for any child, and where morbid obesity is twice ideal body weight. Unfortunately, lifestyles have changed over the years. You know, these days, you know, we have fast food, and convenience is very, very key in our lives. And, you know, when, you know, you and I were kids, for fun, we'd go outside and play tag and other athletic sports with our friends. These days, you know, most activities are indoor and sedate, playing Xbox 360 and other text messaging to your friends rather than going walking down the street to see a friend. So we have much more of a sedentary lifestyle, and a number of obesity has gone up. More than half our population is not considered to be obese. So, you know, obesity, not only does it affect adults, but it also affects the children, and it impacts every organ system in our bodies, and it affects every life aspect of our lives, and that translates all the way into the operating room when we have to take care of somebody. You know, when someone who's obese, their breathing has changed, the amount of effort on the heart has changed, the way the metabolism is affected, the way that the stomach digests food, and the amount of greater acidity in the stomach has increased. So there's so many different aspects that now have impacted and made the actual care of the individual much more difficult, and has increased the risk of both surgery and anesthesia, both for child and adult who are morbidly obese.
I would think definitely as an anesthesia, under anesthesia, the breathing, how do you monitor that? I don't even know myself what are the vital signs that you look for, and how you keep somebody breathing regularly under
anesthesia. amnesia affects multiple organ systems, and we did see, you know, very recently, we're very one of our great celebrities that was sustained under anesthesia by who's Michael Jackson, and
right.
his doctor, who's
right.
not properly monitored. These anesthetics, you know, we cannot take lightly that they affect an individual profoundly, both the breathing and the cardiovascular, the heart and vascular system. So effectively that you need to have this individual in a controlled setting, which is in a hospital with monitors and so forth. You cannot give someone anesthesia very lightly and walk away and talk on a cell phone because the consequences are so, so extremely severe. And when you get to that aspect of a lifestyle where it's rich or famous, these things are so taken so lightly that we don't realize what happens until the consequences hit the tabloids.
Yeah, that's kind of, that was kind of a strange thing. But we, but under normal circumstances, going into surgery, which I have recently, and going from, like, for instance, from an emergency room situation, like I'm taking my own experience, but going from an emergency room situation, I was so impressed that you guys were able to put me into an operating room. So quickly, within a couple of hours, not having prepped for more than that. I mean, you saved my life, and I appreciate everything you guys did for that. But how did you know? I mean, when you're working with somebody from an emergency room or a trauma situation, they have to go into ER right away. As an anesthesiologist, where you know you have so many things, you have to be, you can't eat or you can't drink for 12 hours or so on and so forth. How are you able to bypass those kinds of rules when you're dealing with an emergency kind of situation?
Well, one of the things that I do, and firsthand experience for yourself, I meet the person firsthand.
Right.
I get
right.
A triage where I am able to ask direct point questions and to be able to assess a person's health
right.
and go through their history of what their medical background is, what kind of medical issues that they've had in the past, and I do a physical exam of that individual to see what their cardiac and respiratory ability is, and also I examine the person's airway, and also the type of surgery that's involved. Steps I need to anticipate in terms of, you know, if there's going to be a great deal of blood loss, if there's going to be a great deal of stress on the heart, what these steps need to be taken into account, and I can then take all this assessment and make a plan of treatment of the anesthetic. What's the type of anesthetic I would need to give this individual that would be the least in terms of risk factors for the type of surgery? And every surgery is different. Every individual is different. So I cannot give a typical anesthetic for any individual. There's no such thing as a cookbook anesthetic. I have to take each individual on their own accord and custom tailor the anesthetic to their needs, whether it's an emergency or it is something that's been planned for weeks in advance. So it's quite an undertaking to be able to provide the perfect care for this person. And unlike in baseball, we have to bat that 1,000 with every individual because we have to bring them through just as they went in with the beginning of the procedure.
Well, we're really appreciative that you batted 1,000 for Leo.
Yeah, man. In such short time, too. It was just hours before I was in the OR, but I was, like, amazed how you, how all of this was all calibrated and ready. And before I knew it, I was... You know, and I, the next thing I knew, I was out. You know, I was in recovery. But, whatever the A team you had working with me was everybody did whatever they did, and it was more than appreciated. But when you're dealing with a child, full grown person, and but when you're dealing with a child or an infant, how do you the technique? I mean, to rush a child into an emergency ward,
under so quickly. Would you use gas, or would you use what would be the more appropriate thing for a child?
Well, it all depends on many things. When we're dealing with someone who's very young, under the age of 5 or 6 years of age, typically not very cooperative. But the benefits are they're small, so they're easier to handle, you know. The anatomy is a little bit different. Up to the age of 2 years, the anatomy changes. You notice a child, normally when they're newborn, they have a larger head than is in proportion for the rest of their body. And that slowly changes as they reach the age of two, and then they become a small adult. Physiologically, the way the body works, it becomes very similar to an adult once they pass the age of two. But before the age of two, they're a completely different creature. The metabolism is faster, the proportions of anatomy are different, and that makes it a little bit more difficult to manage from the anesthetic perspective. But after the age of two, they're very much like a little adult. But again, when they come to the age of two, there are other things that go into hand. They're more apprehensive. There are separation anxieties that go into hand. So we have to use other techniques of coercing them to become more relaxed and comfortable. And that's why something like the book Will It Hurt becomes helpful for parents, because children often look at their parents and to see how to respond to a situation. And when the parents are comfortable and they're confident about the situation, the children tend to be a little more comfortable and trusting about the situation. But if the parents are incredibly anxiety-ridden, uncertain, and very responsive, hyper-reactive in the situation, the child is going to be similar to that. They're going to be also very hyper-reactive and a little more difficult to deal with. So I have to not only deal with it medically, but also take into account behaviorally what's going on in that family dynamic and get that child prepared for surgery as quickly as possible.
I really agree with you 100%. The other thing that I like what you said in your book was that there's now pain management for infants, because there was a while ago the thought that infants didn't feel or maybe didn't remember their pain. But I was glad to read that piece where you said that the medical establishment has changed their opinion on that.
Well, absolutely. It wasn't not that long ago, just 10, 15 years ago, that it was believed that infants did not feel pain.
Right.
But, you know, it's come to know that, you know, that traumatizes a child to an unbelievable degree when we don't take into account that a child can feel pain. So we do have to treat a child like we treat an adult in terms of pain management, because we could leave a child or an infant psychologically traumatized for all of life. And for those of us who remember and had surgery in our childhood when ether was present, we all remember what a horrific experience that was.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it myself,
So we do take care of the children as we would take care of the adults in terms of pain management, because we don't want them to be scarred psychologically for a lifetime. So,
you know, this may sound odd, but it's probably one of the most traumatic things an infant could probably do is be circumcised. Okay, but how would they, you know, is that considered pain or at that age, or do they, or, you know, because kids cry?
Well, circumcision is a very unique situation, because there is a multiple religious and cultural aspects of it that is deep in tradition. When we do a circumcision under surgical circumstances, we provide it for complete anesthetic.
Right.
Yeah, and when a child is first born, they do circumcision with local anesthetic, but when a person gets a little bit older, we provide an anesthetic that's a little more profound than just a local anesthetic that makes it less traumatic for the individual.
Right. I just didn't know, you know, what kind of a scar that leaves on one with a local anesthetic, you know. You know, you see them doing the, yeah, it's like, okay.
I wanted to talk talk a little bit about your book, Golden Apples, which I really like a lot. Is that a medieval tale that is an approach to drug education.
It's a beautiful illustrated
book. It is. It's a beautiful, beautiful book, and it has a great message. And would you tell our audience why you wrote this book? And I think it's a great story.
The inspiration came about in my medical school when I was starting my clerkships in 1989, and I was doing a pediatric clerkship at Lincoln Hospital, South Bronx, and three young teenagers came under my care who were addicted to crack cocaine. And I was deeply inspired that I felt that there needed to be something to be done to reduce the temptations of drug abuse. And it was there that I began this incredible journey of educating myself about drug and alcohol addiction. And I became involved with the Office of Substance Abuse Prevention out of Maryland. And under their auspices, I began to write this children's book because it became apparent that it is much easier to prevent an individual from becoming addicted to drugs than to treating them from recovering from drugs, because there's more than an 80% failure rate when you get to that stage. And it was most effective to get to kids before they were under the influence of peer pressure. And we know when there's peer pressure in our kids, when our children come to us and say, Johnny's mom lets them do this. Now we know the kid is under the stress of peer pressure. We see from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration that from their reports that one out of three children will do drugs or will use administered drugs, illicit drugs, before they reach adulthood. And that number is incredibly astounding. And we live in a society of denial because majority of parents will not believe that their children are susceptible to drug use until it's too late. If you have a child, and I was astounded because I used to go and provide talks and read the books to children grammar schools, and I would find some second graders would actually educate me on how to roll a joint. And I was astonished how they would know this. And they knew this from watching their parents or their older siblings do this. Now, if this second grader knows how to do this, so does their rest of their classmates.
Yeah.
Because they are now, most of these kids and these children, regardless of the background, they are subjected to individuals in their classroom who are also exposed to different lifestyles.
And they share that information right away.
Education becomes the most powerful tool in a parent's hands. This is when you need to be able to, as a parent, as a teacher, as an educator, to intervene and to educate these children why drug use, alcohol use, or smoking is detrimental to an individual's health. Because once a person becomes involved with drugs or alcohol, it's just a slippery slope. And we know places like Mountainside and Silver Hills are full of individuals trying to recover from drug use, which has over 80% failure rate.
Yeah, many people have to go back many, many times before they can
The Golden Apples is not just a message about drug use. It became a fairy tale with a caveat of multiple messages. It has messages about stranger danger, peer pressure, bullying. It emphasizes the quality of family life and delayed gratification and education. So the book itself, it's a fairy tale with a metaphorical tale about these different lessons. It becomes a very powerful tool for a parent as it became as the first how-to book of success. You know, it's got the little steps of what you need to do to get to a successful self. And, like, you know, way back in the Middle Ages, this is how our children were educated, was through fairy tales. learned about. And this is how the book was designed to be like.
This is a great book. It's a great springboard for a discussion with children. You know, children think that everybody has their best interests at heart, and it's a shock to them when they find out that they don't.
Right. And it's specifically designed from kindergarten to fifth graders,
mm-hmm.
because once they get to middle school, that's when peer pressure kicks in. And
that's right.
So when peer pressure kicks in, you as a parent have a smaller voice than Johnny, who's in his classroom, was a friend. Because when you get to that age, we all want to be loved. You know, regardless of what it is, children specifically like to feel accepted. You know, and it's often we drop our level of standard to be accepted and to be loved by our peer group. Regardless of who our peer group is, peer group could be a friend, could be your parents, could be the people you hang out with, could be people on TV as your peer group. But that's when, with your background in education, comes truly key role in a person's life when they get to that stage of their lives.
And we're fighting a lot of children today are getting such poor messages from the media. I mean, we see so much violence, so much substance abuse in the media, but they don't necessarily see the dark side of it, the consequence of it, and they don't really internalize that kind of message. And that's what they have to get from parents and educators and concerned adults.
We live in a society of back and forth. Many of the parents feel that it is the school or the teacher's responsibility to educate children in certain aspects, and parents and teachers and school feel that it's the parents' responsibility to educate certain things. So there's a big back and forth. I think there needs to be ownership on all aspects
mm-hmm.
of individuals, whether it's parents or teachers, to be able to enroll. This book hasn't gone anywhere because there is this, the schools don't have the budget to purchase a book like this, and parents don't feel that they need to educate their kids because they come through a certain background, because they associate with certain individuals, or they have a certain income. But, you know, drug use and misbehavior has no boundaries, whether it is socio-economical background makes no difference.
I was curious as to how the people react, how doctors are reacting now to the to so much of this drugging of the kids. Okay, Ritalin and ADHD and hypertension and and also I wanted to know, are there more allergies? Are there more allergic allergies that are being noticed or kids are getting now due to pollution or different other things? Is there an increase in that?
There's always allergies. I mean, we look at allergies, most common allergies to penicillin. But the more medications that we use, there's more chance of reactions to these medications. There's no specific way of determining what the allergy would be. You know, as an individual uses more medications, of course, the chances of a reaction to a medication will increase. So there's no way of predicting that.
There's a lot of criticism now today, and rightfully so, that that around medicating kids, who are either hyperactive or are just or have ADD or ADHD or other symptoms. What's your opinion on that? Do you think that it's being over medicated, or do you think that it's just
We're sorry if we're putting you on the spot there.
I just a question, right? Is that
a foreign thing? Either we've become very good at diagnosing ADHD, or that we're Google industry has increased there. I don't think the incidence of ADD, ADHD has gone up. I think it's been where it has been. I think that there are other factors currently that are involved, because we have seen a skyrocket use of Ritalin and patients for ADHD and ADD in the last 5 to 10 years. I forget the figures, but I think the company that makes Ritalin sold over, and this was an article published by Johns Hopkins, over $2 billion of this medication was sold per year starting about 5 or 6 years ago.
Wow.
So the pharmaceutical industry has tremendous interest in ADD and ADHD. I believe that there is an overdiagnosis of the ADD and ADHD because it's not something new. It has always been around, but there have been other modalities of dealing with ADD and ADHD, including behavioral, educational. I myself have had ADD, ADHD, and I never needed the medication, only because other modalities have been used, both athletics and increased educational modalities, to deal with this aspect. I mean, having ADD or ADHD is not a disability. It's just having a different way of dealing with life.
I have to agree with you on that in many ways, and I think that... I always wondered about myself, and it wasn't until I grew up that I realized I probably was ADD, ADHD, and everything else. But when we were kids, that didn't mean anything. You just either went your own way or did whatever you did and got through school and it just seems. Suddenly it was these things that were normal for us growing up in the baby boom years were suddenly problems, you know, that everyone had to deal with. It was with drugs. And we didn't, I don't know, we just didn't deal with them that way. You dealt with it through education, or you dealt with it through sports, or you dealt with it through extracurricular activities of some sort, right?
We've gotten to the era that you go to a doctor's office, you come out with a script.
Yeah.
That's become the normalcy. We have pills for weight loss. We have pills for stopping smoking. We have pills of erectile dysfunction. There's a pill for everything now. And, I'm just amazed at the number of medications that are dispensed, which is an incredible magnitude.
Mm. Yeah, I am too.
Well, if you watch any TV at all, those are the only ads that you see, starting right off with the news in the morning. They have all kinds of drug ads and pharmaceutical ads, and it seems to me that they encourage people to go to the doctor to get these particular drugs. They must go in and ask for them.
Yeah.
And with these syndromes that I never even heard of half the time.
What I'm amazed is that they've taken the responsibility from the physician and placed in the hands of the consumer.
Absolutely.
And, despite the side effects of, you can pick a medication, whether it could cause heart attack, death, to paralysis, but it may be the right medication for yourself. Just ask your doctor.
Yeah, it's like for every 1 minute advertisement for anything, any televised drug, there's at least 30 seconds of that is the hazards of taking it, you know.
But that doesn't seem to stop people.
No,
we're a society that likes to do that. But that certainly is a discussion for another day. We've come to the end of our time. But I wanted to find out from you where people could get your book, Will It Hurt, if they have if they're going in for surgery or a family member or a child.
Well, I work at Sharon Hospital, and the gift shop at Sharon Hospital does carry copies of these books. And the economic downturn has certainly turned down the flow, because it's not a Harry Potter book. Neither one of them are.
But I notice it's on Amazon.com. You can pick the book up there, right?
It is. I think that the Golden Apple is no longer carried on Amazon.com because of the decrease in volume of sales over the last two, 3 years. And there are a few copies of Will It Hurt that are still circulating. But certainly, people who are in the listening range get a copy from the Sharon Hospital gift shop.
Yeah.
And I hope that doctors out there that are listening who have children in their practice with children who, and they maybe have some who are going into surgery, I hope they recommend your book. I think it would be a great comfort for any parent to have, and I would certainly encourage them to purchase that book. It would be take a lot of the worry and anxiety away.
And when do you think the next book will be coming out for the one for adults?
There are several books in the works right now. My goal, hopefully, is to find someone who has got a background, because the book business is not my business, that is knowledgeable enough to help me get either an agent or a publisher to help navigate through these things. I have an adult version of Will It Hurt, which is 98% complete. I have other books that are very similar to Golden Apples. I have one that's called Hidden Cavern that deals with alcoholism. I was working with another version of the similar book that deals with the dangers of physical relationships for young adults. And now I'm working on a novel that is still in the beginning stages right now.
Can you tell us, give us a little peek into your novel at all, or your idea, or you want to keep it quiet?
I like to keep it quiet. It's a little bit of an autobiography, a lot of fiction involved with it.
Well, we'll look forward to that. That sounds very exciting.
As a and for your professional, if anybody wants to reach you professionally, they can always get you at the Sharon Hospital.
Absolutely, at Sharon Hospital. Anyone can reach me there.
As Dr. Ketchup there. And Doc, I want to thank you so much for being on, and I hope people will rush down to Sharon Hospital there and pick up a copy. Like I say, it's still available. I checked on Amazon.com, so if you can.
Well, thank you very, very much, and thank you for having me.
Well, it was a pleasure to have you on the show.
Yeah.
All right.
So good night, sir.
Good night.
Talk to you guys soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Dr. Armin Ketchidian, Dr. Ketch from Sharon Hospital, talking about his book, Will It Hurt? A Parent's Practical Guide to Children's Surgery, and also his fairy tale, a metaphorical tale, Golden Apples, about manipulation and drug addiction. An excellent book. I really, really like it.
He's a great guy, too.
Yeah, he's a wonderful guy, and obviously multi-talented.
I want to give a shout-out there to our credit to the hospital, Sharon Hospital.
They have some great people down there.
One heck of a staff and a heck of a bunch of great folks. And they saved my life, so if they can do that, they can do it for me, they can do it for you.
Okay, Leo, top of the hour, station ID.
Yeah, this is WQQQ 103.3. Okay, and I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Of course, that was a recorded from last night's WQQQ show. And if you're interested, if you happen to have a kid who's undergoing surgery, or somebody that it might be like that, you might want to check out Amazon.com. Check out Will It Hurt by Dr. Ketch. There's a couple of there are some books available there. You can also, if you happen to live in the Northwest Connecticut area, near Sharon, Connecticut, where Sharon Hospital is, they have a gift center there, gift shop, and his books are on display there. You can get it there. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight, and talk to you again tomorrow.